Welcome to Designed for More, brought to you by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Join Dr. Timothy Jennings, a renowned expert in psychiatry, neuroscience, and spiritual well-being, as he explores the connections between mind, body, spirit, and relationships.
Hello, welcome to Designed for More, sponsored by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. I'm Dr. Tim Jennings, and I'm joined today by Danielle Rome, one of our therapists here at the clinic, and James Johnson, our chief of chaplains. And today, our program is going to be answering questions from you, our audience. And so, guys, our first question that has come in is, if Adam and Eve didn't sin in the Garden of Eden, how do you think God would have taught us how to build our character?
I don't think our character would have been broken to begin with.
Okay, there would have been no sin. If they didn't sin, they'd been perfect, right? Right, yeah, so that's true. But is that what character is?
Well, I mean, is
sinlessness character?
Right, it can be part of it, right? That's the goal of our character is to determine, you know, what kind of person we are, what are our values, what are our ethics, how do we live in the world, how do we connect with each other, with relationships, and of course, how do we relate to God? As well as, you know, one of the really cool things that God created when he made the heavens and the earth, he made structures, he made designs, he made hierarchies. And all of those interrelated connections and relationships require interaction. And so as Adam and Eve, in the beginning, they got truth directly from God. They didn't have to filter it through any crazy design matrix. God told it to them. It must be true.
And don't you think Gabriel and holy angels were visiting with them?
No, absolutely.
So they had interaction with intelligent beings.
Oh, yeah. The heavenly family and the physical family would have definitely, you know, been in connection for sure.
Yeah. Even character development in a sinful world still involves being taught by God.
So I have an idea here, but let's see if we're on the same page first. My view has been that God can create sinless beings, and he does, but character cannot be created.
Right.
Character has to be developed by the choices of the beings. Mm-hmm. We develop by if we're free beings. Now, robots don't develop character. Mm. Computers don't develop character. But character is who we become based on free choice. Mm. Yes?
Yeah.
Are we in agreement with that?
Yeah.
Okay. So God created them sinless and flawless, and they corrupted themselves by their choices. But it was not a requirement they did that.
Right.
Okay. So my view is then that the way they would have developed mature, sinless, eternally sealed and settled, godlike character, that was the purpose of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Mm-hmm. The tree of knowledge, note this is a tree of knowledge of good and evil. It wasn't the tree of knowledge of evil. It was good and evil. And it was, my understanding is, the place where they would have the opportunity to exercise their free will choice and decide what they would know, not didactic. This is not the tree of didactic education or cognitive comprehension. It is that tree of what you know by experience in your being. Will they choose to reject the lies and thereby embrace the truth and thereby know loyalty, love, faithfulness, goodness, trust? Will they know the good? Or will they choose to believe the lies and thus know fear, selfishness, guilt, shame, and all of the devastating things that sin has brought? Rebellion, betrayal. Will they know those things? Not as a cognitive concept. See, Gabriel knows cognitively what betrayal is. He's seen it. He doesn't know it in experience.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so I believe the tree of knowledge of good and evil was placed there for them to exercise their own free will abilities and choose what character they would develop. What do you think about that idea?
I would agree with that. Yeah. And so they could develop character also by choosing not to.
Yeah, that's right. They could develop good and mature character and ultimately be settled or sealed such that once they've weighed them out, come to that conclusion, made that choice, then, as you know, if you've made choices, even in our fallen state, there's certain things you've had temptation on or been faced with, and you've weighed them out, and then you've made a choice on it. And you set, based on, you know, the different lines of evidence and life experiences and biblical revelation and so forth, you've made a choice on it and you've settled that question. You're really not open to temptation on that anymore. Isn't that true?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we won't go into the neurobiology, but I would just say, in principle, when you make those choices, it actually changes your neurobiology in ways that makes you less vulnerable to, you know, those temptations in the future.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that we don't get to see because of how history unraveled, but I often wonder how cool it would have been for Adam and Eve to continue, because the family was the original vehicle that God created to bring his kingdom here on earth. And we have the church now, thankfully, as the backup, but the family is still the primary vehicle that we learn how to develop as people, you know. And how cool would it have been for Adam and Eve to have raised children in that atmosphere and have them develop, you know, as children, we have to learn, we have to experience. And how cool would it have been for them to pour that into their children and for them to experience God, not just for that short period of time, however long it was in the garden before sin, but for eternity.
Oh, no, I love that. Okay. Yeah. And no, total agreement, like just harmony here. But that opens up a whole new perspective on some of God's purposes that were undermined.
Mm-hmm.
Because doesn't the Bible tell us that in 1 Corinthians 4:9, that we are a theater, a spectacle to angels, mm-hmm, and to men, that angels long to look into these things.
Right.
Okay. And there was this disruption in the heavenly family,
mm-hmm,
already going on when God created Adam and Eve. And aren't we told we're created in the image of God?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so as you're describing this, think about the Godhead coming into the unity of love, because the triune unit, and they create in their image two now distinct individualities coming into the unity of love. That's God designed the marriage relationship and procreating beings in their image. And then in this world without sin, raising them. Is there a lesson there? Would Adam and Eve had children to exploit, dominate, control, abuse, or constantly give of themselves, mm-hmm, sacrificially in love for the welfare of their children? And then the universe goes, oh my goodness, those questions that were raised by the enemy about God being a power monger, an authoritarian dictator, and so forth, are exposed as false as Adam and Eve govern this planet as a microcosm of God governing his universe.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You see, there's. I mean, I love that, and it brings in lessons, I think. And this is my personal view is why Adam and Eve were so viciously targeted by Satan in the rebellion, because if you want to use the human metaphor, in that context, this planet became like the heavenly, you know, headline news,
mm-hmm,
where everybody's watching for the answers, and Satan wanted to corrupt it so we would actually misrepresent and teach falsehoods.
That's right.
About God. And so Christ came. Not only to save humankind, but to set the record straight. And it says in Colossians, all things in heaven and in earth are reconciled to Christ at the cross through the shedding of his blood.
That's right.
Interesting.
That's right.
Yeah. See all the connections?
Yeah, that's interesting. I've never thought about that.
Yeah.
And to bring it back to character,
yeah,
by them having and raising children, that would further develop their character even without,
yeah,
without sin.
Yes. Yeah. So for the answer, sin was not necessary for character, mm-hmm, development.
Yeah.
In fact, sin is what has interfered with godly character development. And we do develop a character one way or the other. And some people are developing, and you see in the world and you through history, people can develop character either to be Christ-like or Satan-like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Next question. What does it mean and how can I recognize someone who has truly, quote, died to self? And how does one sustain it? What does it mean? Let's try to break that up. Three questions. What does it mean to die to self? The biblical language of die to self. How can we recognize if someone has died to self? And how do we sustain it? So first question, what does it mean?
Well, it's a, you know, the aligning of ourself with God's design laws. You know, we know the law of love tells us that everything that lives gives. But that is contrary to our sinful nature, you know, our sin sickness of selfishness, that we come into this world with a selfish desire to be served rather than to serve others. But that actually goes against what we want. We want love, but we have to give it in order to get it. Like we mentioned earlier, that Adam and Eve's character would have been to give selfless service to somebody else, and they would have reaped the benefit of godly character and love in the process. And so when we look at these ideas of dying to ourself, it's saying that I know I have this desire that is unhealthy, it's selfish, it's sinful. I have to make the willful decision, and hopefully through the power of the Holy Spirit, that's the only way real transformation can happen in our lives, to act against that nature and to act in love, knowing that I'm putting away what I may selfishly want for myself in order to give to other people in what's most beneficial in our loving relationships with each other.
That makes sense. I'm thinking about the wording of dying to self, because what is self? So are we killing the self, okay, or are we killing something for the sake of the self?
Oh, I love that.
I'm realizing I've never thought of the word. Well done.
Yes.
Yeah.
So dying to self. How about dying to selfishness?
Mm-hmm.
Dying
to selfishness.
Or can we rephrase it to like modern English of like killing selfishness?
Okay.
Because the dying to, the wording is like messing with my understanding of it.
But this is a good question. Can a selfish person, by exercising their own power, purge or rid themselves of their own selfishness?
Probably not.
So can we kill the selfishness, or do we have to surrender the self to our higher power? And the Holy Spirit then comes in with new animating energy. And I'm gonna describe it in a second. But in that process, mm-hmm, we are dying or surrendering self voluntarily. So we're dying by letting go, but we actually can't kill the self.
Right.
There is a difference there, isn't there? And in fact, many of the major religious systems of the world, Eastern philosophies, are about overcoming this fear. So fear drives self-centeredness, survival drives. What makes people self-centered or selfish is fear. Fear of abandonment, fear of rejection, fear of getting harmed. And so they look to self-protect. And so it's vigilance towards whether I'm going to get money, whether I'm going to get power, whether I'm going to rise over, I'm going to be smarter. It's all driven by fear. Okay, as soon as Adam and Eve sinned, they ran in it because they were afraid. And this fear is corrosive to us. It's contrary to love. Perfect love casts out fear. And the Eastern philosophies tried to do, through self-directed emptying meditation, overcome their own inherent fear. That's what the Eastern meditation practices are all about, which is just the opposite of the Christian philosophy, is which we don't turn inward and empty. We turn upward and we focus our minds on Christ. And by beholding him, we become changed to the point we come to a point we trust him and we open ourselves and we receive a supernatural empowering presence. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so let's see if we can make this very practical for our listeners, though, and try to connect it with the Bible. Because everything you said is right, and I love your question. It's so insightful. It's very right on.
Thanks.
Yeah. I might have missed that, and mm-hmm, so I really appreciate it, because I am so... We miss things when we have we've heard it so long,
yeah,
that we have already understood it in a way that is interpreted the way, when I say something, I'm thinking selfishness, but you are right. There's a self. God does not want us to destroy our individuality, our personhood, our identity, our self. He wants to free the self, right, from the infecting elements of fear and selfishness,
right,
and attach and reform our identity, empowered and built off of love and trust.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so, when God created Adam and animated him to energy, animated him to life, breathing him the breath of life, he came alive, motivated, animated by love. There was no fear in Adam. There's no fear in Eve. They're completely motivated by love and trust and a face-to-face relationship with God. But as soon as they sinned, as soon as they believed lies about God, they ran and hid because they were afraid. Their motivating energy was no longer love and trust. It's fear and survival. And they took fig leaves, hid themselves, tried to make themselves better. That's the survival drives. And Adam and Eve, that's the life now that they have, the animating life, motivating energy. That's all they have to share in procreation. And so we're all born, as the Bible says in Psalm 51, in sin, conceived in iniquity. We're born animated, motivated by fear and insecurity. And that's why Jesus told Nicodemus, unless you're born again, you cannot see the kingdom of heaven. Born again, dying to self is being born again. And it's where the self detaches from being primarily motivated by fear and me first, and primarily motivated by love for and trust in God.
I love the mental image that comes when you picture the self being detached from that and then reattaching to God and truth and love. Yeah.
And then that is the, and when somebody really makes that choice, that is the conversion experience, which can happen like this. It can also happen gradually. There is some, for some people, it's a process of slowly being one. Others, it is a moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens, that moment of heart motivational change is in the substructure of our brain.
Wow.
And then once we have a new heart, this is what you read in Romans 7, once we have a new heart, a heart that wants to do the right thing, that heart, that motive, that animating, I want to glorify the Lord. I want to bless others. I want to be a loving person. But then we find as we go to carry out the duty, we stumble. We fall. Why? Because that motive is now trying to be lived out on a neurobiology that has networks that were formed when we were still practicing fear and self-centeredness. And so we have habit patterns, conditioned responses, biases and prejudice that haven't been removed, false beliefs about what's right and wrong. We have much of our neurobiology that when we have a good heart motive where we're born is still not matured. And this is where that whole Romans 7 is. The things I want to do, sometimes I'm not doing them. And the things I don't want to do, I find myself doing. Oh, what a wretched man am I, who will save me from this body of death. Okay. That's not an unconverted person. That is a converted person who, when they realize they're falling short, they're grieved. They don't want to fall short anymore. Yeah. The unconverted person, when they fall short, they don't even recognize it half the time or most of the time. And then they will defend it and have every right to be this way. And that person deserves what they got.
Yep.
You see the difference?
Absolutely.
And so the answer to the question, how do we know? Is your heart grieved? Do you long to mature? Do you find yourself moving forward over time and becoming more Christ-like? Do you have a love in your heart for God and others? Or are you primarily still motivated by fear of rejection, what people will think, making a mistake, legal condemnation, trouble in the judgment day?
Yeah.
That makes sense. So,
that's really cool.
Yep. So how do we recognize it in someone else?
Well, I mean, they're going to have the fruit of the Spirit in that regard, to where they are making that volitional decision to say, God, I want things your way, and I'm choosing that. And I think that's you hit on it, but I think it's really key, is that God doesn't force himself on people. He respects his own laws, and we have to choose to partner with him. That, you know, he said, you know, that's what Paul echoed that in a different passage, where it said, I've been crucified with Christ. It's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives within me. Echoing what Jesus said, that we have to daily pick up our cross and follow him, that it's a continual daily.
Okay, so how would I continue to sustain that? Mm-hmm. That's a daily. So you're answering that question now too. So I just want to point that, we're answering that out. Good job. Yeah.
But that we see that in other people when we see the fruits of the Spirit in their life of love, patience, goodness, you know, gentleness, self-control, that they're able to love not with selfish intent, because we can love with selfish intent. I can give to other people, but it's always with the selfish motivation of receiving that.
I want to pull out what you just said, right? Because you said it right. You said it quickly, like me.
Okay. Slow down. Yeah.
Okay. You said it quickly. And so I want people to hear what you said. By their fruits, yet you said, sometimes those fruits of loving behaviors, those same behaviors can be done from an unconverted or selfish heart. Mm-hmm. So the behavior alone, in other words, we ultimately at the end of the day can't really judge someone's heart.
Exactly. Yes.
So now it's not our place to judge the heart, mm-hmm, ultimately, but we certainly, I think, some people will reveal themselves from the abundance of the heart, the mouth, the mm-hmm person who overtly, and there are people out there who overtly hate Jesus and talk about that.
Knowing a tree by their fruit kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, there are some you can tell, but my point is the whole parable of the field that had the wheat, which are the righteous, also had the tares. And my understanding is the tares are very similar in appearance to the wheat in the field. It's hard to tell. And they grow up together until the harvest.
Mm-hmm.
And when they, in the parable, who did this? You sowed the good seed in your field. Where did these weeds come from? An enemy has sown these seeds. And so in the body of believers, it's the church, you will have the righteous and you will also have the wicked. And Christ is planted in the righteous and the enemy is planted in the wicked in the church.
Wow.
And he said, should we pull out the weeds in the parable? No, because the roots are entangled.
Mm-hmm.
the connections. The righteous will have loving bonds and connections with some of the wicked in the church. And if you try to pull the wicked out, you will pull some of the righteous out who will have their hearts hurt and feel betrayed by the system. That's huge.
Wow.
So you leave them till the harvest and let at the harvest, the harvester separate.
Wow.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So ultimately, I don't try to really tell unless it's obvious and overt offense and abuse and evil being perpetrated. Then we're called to set healthy boundaries on that.
Yes. Yeah. Wow.
All right. Next question. It's a little bit longer, a little description here. It says, I've listened to Design for More episode on grief several times, and it was very helpful to me. I lost my husband a little over 2 years ago and feel overall I'm doing well, though there has been a few things that keep nagging at me. We were married over 40 years and were not happily married. He was very demanding and angry, and that showed itself in all areas of our marriage. I so wanted to be happy and be at peace within myself in spite of this, but I was never able to achieve that while he was alive. I was tense, anxious, had nightmares, panic attacks, became tense every time I walked into the door of the home I love when he was at home. I am now much more at peace, love being in our home, and enjoy the peace and quiet of being alone, and my relationship with God has blossomed. I feel his presence with me, and I'm loving that. I do feel somewhat guilty over this, though. There is this nagging voice telling me I should have been able to achieve this peace no matter the storm going on around me. What are your thoughts on this? I'm going to start with you on this one, Danielle, because you're our resident therapist. What do you think about this? First off, as you hear it, do you disentangle the different elements?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So, So are there elements that are, is it surprising she struggled to find peace in a marriage that is functioning the way she described it? Is that surprising?
No, it's not surprising. And the part that stands out.
Why is that not surprising? Let's say, why is that not surprising?
Well, when you're in a situation where you're constantly exposed to, and when specifically in a marriage, when you're that intertwined with somebody that's that overtly disruptive, and I don't know all of the details of the relationship.
Right, right. But
based on her describing her experience and what it was like for her, I don't know how you would feel peace and stay in that dynamic.
So metaphors.
Yeah.
Can you actually have a sense of physical wellness if somebody is beating you with a belt every day?
No.
I mean, will you be able to feel physically relaxed and physically good if you're getting beat with a belt every day?
No, you'd be injured in your body.
And yes, you'll be bruised and you might be bleeding and then no matter what ointment you put on it, if you get a beating again the next day, it never heals.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think understanding how reality works, it really isn't possible to have that peace, the real fullness and thriving. Okay. And even if we look at Jesus on his crucifixion weekend, he had peace with himself and peace with God. But I don't believe anywhere we have described that he goes, man, this is an enjoyable weekend. I'd like to do it again next weekend.
Yeah.
There was nothing part of that he enjoyed. It was agonizing. He talked about the agony that he was in Gethsemane to his disciples. So he had peace with who he was.
Yes.
He had peace with his father. Okay.
Yeah.
But what was happening did not bring ultimate total peace to his experience. Is that fair to say, Pat?
Yeah.
And we've talked about this before, but just as a reminder that peace, while if we're at peace, we can experience happiness, but peace and happiness aren't the same thing. That you can, like I said, I can have peace with God, but still not have peace in my home. Peace is the absence of conflict. And so it sounds like she lived in a home that was full of that.
And then happiness is a byproduct of healthiness.
Exactly.
Yes.
And in an unhealthy home, there will be an undermining of true contentment and happiness. You can't be content.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have contentment in dysfunction.
Yeah. And I want to add about
something
else that stood out to me is the guilt piece. Something that I've seen is that in relationships like this, people hold on to a little piece of hope that eventually the other person will change. And when that person dies, what's left over is the hope that was never met. And so I think that's also part of the grieving, is that potentially, and again, I don't know all the details of this listener's story, but what I could see is potentially that hope being what's left over and needing to grieve that it never really became what maybe she was.
So grieving an unrealized dream or hope.
Yes. Okay. And then the guilt can in some cases maybe be a protection against having to grieve that loss of hope, because if she holds responsibility for it never being the way it was, then she doesn't have to place that responsibility onto her husband for not changing and taking initiative and healing.
I think that's a really good insight, and I agree. I think it's a factor. It's one of the slices or wedges in the process needs to be looked at. Yeah. I think there's another element here too, though, and that is, which I've seen often in these cases, is confusing the emotional reaction. Is it wrong if you've been beaten every day for 40 years, whether verbally, emotionally, or physically, and the beatings stop, that you feel relief? Ah, that you feel even some joy. You feel some happiness. You're glad you're not going to be beaten. You can come in your home and feel safe. You can come into your home and feel secure. You can come in your home and not worry about the attack that's going to. Is it wrong to actually feel good about that?
No.
Or is that actually good? Is that a normal, predictable, and reasonable emotional response?
Yes.
Okay. Is that the same, though, as being glad that the husband is dead? Is that the same emotion? I'm glad he's dead. That's not the same thing at all. And many people have, because the death has resulted in the relief of the abuse, and they're glad over the release and the relief of the abuse, get confused in their emotional world. How can a loving Christ-like wife be glad her husband died?
Yeah.
And they will feel guilt. Yeah. Because they have misplaced their relief on the fact he died.
Yep.
Rather than the fact the abuse stopped. Yep. She'd be much more relieved and happy if he'd had a true conversion experience and became a Christ-like husband and treated a husband like Paul writes, sacrificing himself for her to have that happy, loving home. That would be much more relieving to her.
Yeah.
But it's righteous to be relieved by the end of the abuse. And that's where people have to be truthful. This is where the truth sets you free, and you have to parse your emotions in the light of the truth. Is it right to be relieved? Yes. Does that mean I wanted to die? No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and another piece in this was she said she felt guilty, and you have the question.
Yeah.
Is she saying that she felt guilty that she wasn't able to get that peace with God?
So there's a nagging voice telling me I should have been able to achieve this peace no matter the storm going on around me.
So that implies that she potentially believes there's something wrong with her for not being able to achieve that. And that touches on what we were saying earlier, where that's more circumstantial, that she couldn't achieve that. Well, but there's a difference between, like you said, having peace between her and God versus having the sense of peace.
Right. And there may be some boundary issues here as well.
Yeah.
When I hear somebody who's been in a relationship in which they're being, let's just use the word abused, for 40 years, what's that about? I mean, seriously. So it sounds to me like there might be some emotional codependency elements here.
Yep. Yeah, some other stuff that maybe she's potentially being convicted of that she can work through and heal now that he's not.
And so codependency is an emotional dynamic in which people will take emotional baggage, responsibilities, and ownership on themselves that's not theirs.
Yeah.
I'm responsible for how he feels. I'm responsible for whether the marriage heals. If I'm better, if I'm good enough, then if I do it all right, then he won't be mad today.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So it's my fault. I worked really hard. I worked, and he never actually. So what did I do wrong?
Yeah.
Okay. That is not being truthful. That is actually taking responsibility for somebody else's conduct. And a mature person would be the person who says, through God's grace, I want to be the healthiest person I can be in governance of me, fulfilling God's purposes, living out his design laws and how I govern myself. But I'm going to leave other people free to govern themselves. And as they govern themselves, I will evaluate what they're revealing to me about themselves from the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks, the good man brings forth good out of the good sort of him, Jesus said. And as my husband treats me this way, it's going to be a revelation to me that he's got issues, he's got struggles. And in love for him, I will not quietly go along and try to be a better in all that I do so he won't be mad. I'm not going to take ownership over that. I'm going to, in love, confront him in loving truth. Hey, you say you're my husband in Christ. Well, Christ doesn't treat the church like you're treating me. What's going on with you? Because I know you want to be a Christ-like husband, but you're not being one.
Yep.
And I love you too much to actually take responsibility for your anger. Mm-hmm. So there's a place for that conversation too. And so maybe there's a piece of this that's being revealed here that she can do some introspection and say, did I take ownership for stuff that wasn't mine? And maybe the Lord would like to free me of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. All right, next question. I'm watching your webcast on mood disorders right now. I am working with a psychologist on my depression. I love the information in this episode. I have been a very pessimistic person since my rebellious preteen and teenage years. I was able to function in day-to-day life, but ever since I developed alcoholism in 2014, I have gone in and out of remission and relapse since then. For the last 10 years, I have declined. I've declined or worsened year after year to the point where I no longer find joy in any part of my life. I can put on a happy face when needed, but even when I experience positive things, I go right back to my mindset of, oh, well, life still sucks and it doesn't really matter. Even when I make myself go out and visit family or make myself be social without alcohol, I am obviously more outgoing with alcohol, they said. So we're going out without alcohol. I still go right back to the feelings that I'm not good enough and I don't care about anything. I know you can't diagnose anything without actually seeing me, but would you say that I have deep clinical depression or persistent depressive disorder due to the severe alcohol consumption for so many years? I would love to be able to come see you, but I live in Texas. So I want to say, first off, it doesn't matter where you live. We have people from all over the world that come to our clinic. So if you want to come to our clinic, call the 1-800 number and talk to our admission team. They will talk to you about the program. They will talk to you about the access. They will talk about the insurance and all of those stuff. So if you're interested and you think that the program is going to help you, give a call to the 1-800 number and talk to them about that possibility. But moving that aside now, thoughts about this person?
Well, I mean, with the alcohol, there's a neurobiological element there. That's going to influence depression. I mean, so there's that piece that it would worsen a problem that's already there. But did I hear correctly that there was a period of time where they were doing really well?
No, they've been pessimistic their whole life. Okay. They've been pessimistic, negative person who has been pretty much a Debbie Downer. I don't know if it's a man or a woman, but that's what they described.
Yeah.
Their whole life, ever since their preteen and teenage years. And then at some point they turned to alcohol to try to self-soothe or alter their mood state, and they only got worse after that.
Well, I'm not hearing anything about their childhood or family dynamics. That usually plays a pretty big role into choices that teenagers make, especially if these issues were starting during teenage years. Likely they were still living with their caretakers at the time. And so I'm wondering what influences may have happened there, if there was any substance use during teenage years that could have impacted development. There's a lot of questions that I have about what they're describing. To have those symptoms lasting for so long and so persistently, there's has to be more to the picture than just, I'm a pessimistic person.
So let's talk about the human being as God designed it and created it. This person, despite upbringing and despite childhood influences.
Right.
And we see patients who have had terrible traumatic childhoods. As adults, do they still have freedom to make choices for themselves?
Yes. Yeah.
Now, those choices are impacted by child, but they still have freedom to make choices. In other words, coming to a place like this is a choice to address and try to resolve problem rather than go get high and simply avoid problem, right?
Right.
Okay. So my point being is the past experiences don't remove our freedom of choice as long as we're still living.
Yes. Yes.
And the way God designed us is that our choices changes in all levels. So drinking alcohol, you alluded to, causes physiological changes in the body, the entire body. Immune system is altered by alcohol. Liver functions are altered by alcohol. Heart functions are altered by alcohol. Brain functions, epigenetics, how genes are turned on and turned off are altered by alcohol. So physiologically, alcohol alters the being, alters ion channels in the brain, alters neural signaling, and it's a central nervous system depressant. So chronic alcohol use increases risk of depression for, and lots of other things as well. So that's a factor. There's no question. That's true. And it's a choice to drink. Mm-hmm. But our patterns of thinking cause changes in the neurobiology. What we watch, what games we play, what God we worship, how we worship, what foods we eat, all of this is changing us. And if you develop a pattern of negative, pessimistic, discouraging, nihilistic interpretations of the world and yourself, the only outcome from that, it's not joy.
Yeah.
It's not hope. It's discouragement and despair. Mm-hmm. And neurobiologically, it changes the neurobiologic substructure of our brain, activates stress circuits, kicks up inflammatory cascades, causing physiologic changes. And then the longer we do this, think about any habit pattern. If you do something over and over and over again, pretty soon you're doing it without even thinking about it.
Yeah.
Whether it's how you brush your teeth and you go into the bathroom before you go to bed and you've got something on you're listening to and you put up the toothpaste and you start brushing, you're not even focusing on brushing your teeth. It's an auto routine that your programming goes through, and you go through the same side of your mouth and the same row, and you're not even aware of it. And sometimes you're so focused on whatever it is you're listening to, you go a few minutes later, hey, did I even brush my teeth? It's an auto, it's because you've done it so much, it's wired in.
Mm-hmm.
Well, people do that with their ways of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Now, could you, and everybody who's listening, if you think about how you brush your teeth, you have a habit. You will use, if it's your right hand or left hand, you'll start in your mouth at a certain point. You'll go through in the same pattern every time. And you have the freedom to change that. And you could start with the other hand, but it would be very awkward. It wouldn't feel right. It'd be very mm-hmm. difficult. There's no pattern there for you. It would actually take mental concentration and focus to do that.
Yep.
But if you were to do that over the course of time, it will eventually create a new pattern. You'll actually wire that in. And if you stop doing it with the other hand over the course of time, that prunes back. A person like this has habituated the patterns of behaving and interpreting. And even when they go out with socialization with people, their patterns of interpreting those socializations, as I'm reading this description, are negative. This is no fun. Nobody drinks here. Bunch of teetotalers, okay? In other words, they're putting interpretations that are pessimistic and discouraging and negative.
Yeah.
It actually will take purposeful work and stop and go, well, let me find seven things I can be thankful for. You know, I'm really thankful for the air conditioning they have here. It's 100 degrees outside in Florida, and we're in an air conditioning. We're really thankful for that. Okay, that's an absolute shift in the way this person processes. Yep. They won't even notice the air conditioning.
Yep.
And over the course of time, if they do that, they will build new patterns, and then they'll start walking through the world and with a different mindset. Can I give you all a metaphor? I know I've been talking a lot. Can I give you all a metaphor?
Absolutely, yeah.
So life can, as a metaphor, be like walking through a rose garden in full bloom. And when you walk through the rose garden, there's beautiful, beautiful roses of all shapes and sizes with wonderful fragrance, but there's lots of thorns. And as we walk down the road of life, it's filled with beautiful roses and beautiful fragrances, but there's lots of thorns. And imagine the person who goes in the rose garden in full blossom, and all they see are the thorns. Thorns, thorns, thorns everywhere. Mm-hmm. They're miserable. But a person who actually focuses on the godly things in this world, the blessings God has provided, the flowers everywhere, they're not, if you've ever gone to a rose garden, you I bet you almost always appreciate the roses, but you're consciously still aware of the thorns in the background. So if you reach out to pull one closer to smell, you're very careful not to get a thorn. You're not ignorant of the thorns, but they don't define your reality.
Yeah.
And many people in the world who's actually been stuck by a thorn become conditioned to only see thorns and they lose all the beautiful flowers of life.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a good metaphor.
Yeah, what you focus on grows. Absolutely.
Yeah. Any more to say to this individual?
One of the things, and this may be a rabbit trail, but one of the things that I've observed a lot with people is that they create some of these patterns of thinking off of a coping or survival mechanism. If everything in life is negative, well, they say, well, I hear this phrase a lot. Oh, I plan for the worst and hope for the best. And that's a survival strategy for them. But if that, becomes a short-term gain, long-term loss,
I'm going to jump on what you're saying because you're exactly right. Thank you for bringing it up. What you're describing are people who've been wounded, hit the thorn, and they haven't healed it.
Mm. Yep.
They haven't healed. And so underneath a lot of the negative, pessimistic people like this, they're angry still. Mm-hmm. They're bitter. They were wrong somewhere. It's not fair. Well, it's not fair.
Yeah.
And they haven't forgiven, perhaps. They haven't worked through the trauma. They don't feel safe. They don't ever want to get hurt again. So they don't want people to get close because they got betrayed, maybe.
Yeah.
So oftentimes people like this, they have some type of wounds. And this is where you started out with, I'd like to know what the childhood is. Are there unresolved wounds there that they're still responding to and they're hurt and bitter by?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's well said, Pastor. Yeah. Other comments, concerns here?
Reach out to admission.
So yeah, come to Honey Lake.
We'd love to.
Well, guys, we have, I think these questions have been great and your guys' answers are awesome. And to our audience, we have just touched on some of the questions. We have a whole long list more, but we're going to have to wind this down for this program. And so thank you for joining us today. And if you have questions, send those in to questions@designformore.net, questions@designformore.net. And we will answer, hopefully, your questions if you send those in to us in a future program. But we're going to follow up with another show to finish off the questions we have here. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you for joining us on Designed for More, brought to you by Come and Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Also, don't forget to check out our other podcasts for more inspiring content.